Let's just pray. Father, thank you are with us through the trials and difficulties of life. I pray that you'd help us to think about that and learn from you today. Amen. Amen. Trials and difficulties. I had a puncture in a pipe in my bathroom this week. It's caused some trials and difficulties for me. But it's interesting. Quite a few people have been talking about just offline and also in the service about difficult things that have been happening. And, you know, life's like that. Now, we've been going through Genesis over the last little while, every time I've spoken. And what I've been trying to do is basically give people a bit of an idea of how the Bible links together. So it isn't just a load of disconnected stories, which sometimes people know and sometimes people don't know. But actually, it has an overarching theme all the way up until Jesus comes in the New Testament. And if you remember, we started off with Adam, and right back at the very, very beginning, and how things all went wrong. And then you'll remember the promise that was given to Adam, or to Eve, in fact, about her seed. So this is the words that are given actually as a curse upon the serpent, Satan. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head, and you will strike his heel. And that's the first promise in the Bible that actually speaks ultimately of Jesus, who is the one who will crush the head of Satan later on. And so way back at the very, very beginning of time, written 4,000 years before Jesus, this is what happens. Then we looked at Abraham. And it's interesting because the story carries forwards through Genesis. And although we haven't had time to look at it, you can see how through Noah and the flood and through other things that happen in Genesis, there's all sorts of trying to stop this promise being fulfilled through the whole destruction of the earth or through the sinfulness of men or all sorts of things. But the promise carries on until we get to Abraham. And then Abraham gets this. The Lord said to Abraham, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great. And you will be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you. And whoever curses you, I will curse, and all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. So the promise is narrowed down. We now know that the promise is going to be fulfilled through one family, through one man. Not through the whole world, but through one man. And so the story begins to focus now on this one man and his descendants and what's going to happen to them. Other things may be happening in the world, but this story is really, really important because this is going to lead up to that early promise being fulfilled. And then we get to Isaac. Now, apart from the fact that Isaac was nearly sacrificed by Abraham, and we talked about that last time, we don't actually get any evidence that Isaac actually hears directly from God in any visions. But we do know that he believed the promise that was given to his father Abraham, and he passed it on to his son Jacob. And so when he blesses Jacob, he says, may he, God, give you and your descendants the blessing given to Abraham, so that you may take possession of the land where you now reside as a foreigner, the land God gave to Abraham. So again, the promise is passing on now to Jacob. And Jacob's life's really interesting as well, but we're not going to look at that. We could, but again, he has a whole range of things that happen to him. But when he sets out, leaving his father behind to go to another part of the country, he lies down and he has a dream. And he sees a stairway to heaven and angels going up and down on it. And when he's doing that, God speaks to him. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and through your offspring. And so we see that this promise is carried on now from Adam through Abraham, through Abraham's descendants now to Jacob. And Jacob has 12 sons. Those 12 sons ultimately become the 12 tribes of Israel. And that's obviously we hear about that a lot later on in the Bible. But he has the 12 sons. But the one son that we're going to look at is called Joseph. Right. And the last three or four chapters in Genesis, I think it's more than three or four chapters in Genesis, are all devoted to the story of this one young man of 17 called Joseph and what happens to him and all the circumstances surrounding his life. And we're going to look at that specifically. How many of you have seen Joseph and his amazing Technicolor dream coat? Hey, there we go. Yes. I don't know, I'm not. I was actually trying. I watched it on YouTube. It's actually on YouTube, so you can actually watch the whole thing with Donny Osmond. So, ladies, Donny Osmond, some of you remember, as Joseph, and it's all on YouTube. And basically, it's quite accurate in terms of the story it tells relating to the Bible. The one slightly inaccurate thing in the story is that it kind of suggests that Joseph did sleep with Potiphar's wife, when actually the Bible very clearly says that's not what happened at all. He rejected it, and that's why she was so angry with him. But apart from that, the story is basically the story as it is in the Bible. Have a what? He doesn't have a colored coat. It says in the Bible, and I'll read it in a little bit, he has a beautiful coat. Okay, it doesn't actually say that it's, multicolored or anything like that, but it does say that it's outstanding in terms of the day. So there we go. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read it, and I would encourage you to read this story. It's actually a good read, and it's quite easy to read as well. But I'm going to read, we're not going to cover all of Joseph today, but let's start with Genesis 27. If you want to find it in your Bibles or not, that's fine. And I'll start at verse 1. Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. This is the account of Jacob's family line. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks, and his brothers, the son of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made him an ornate robe. Okay, so it's an ornate robe. It's not a multicolored robe, but that's fine. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, he hated him, and he would not speak a kind word to him. Joseph had a dream, and when he told his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf arose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered round mine and bowed down to it." His brothers said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And he hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Then he had another dream. He told it to his brothers. He said, "Listen, I had another dream. And this time the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me." When he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you had? Will your mother and your brothers actually come and bow down on the ground before you?" His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept this matter in mind. Dreams. I'm going to read you another little story. Now, I know some of you may have heard this, because I may have used this in the past before, but it would have been a while ago. But let me read this, and guess who this person was. In the last decade of the Victorian era, an obscure public schoolboy made a prophecy about the British Empire's fate in the coming century. "I see vast changes coming over a now peaceful world. Great upheavals, terrible struggles, wars such as one cannot imagine. And I tell you, London will be in danger. London will be attacked, and I shall be very prominent in the defense of London. I see further ahead than you do. I see the future. The country will be subjected somehow to a tremendous invasion. But I tell you, I shall be in command of the defenses of London, and I shall save London and the Empire from disaster." Has anybody got any idea who that was? It was Winston Churchill. He was 17 when he stood on a hill and said that to Merlin Evans, who later became an ambassador. Merlin remembered that and wrote it in his own biography to say, "This is what Churchill had actually said to me." Now, I find that absolutely amazing, that Churchill, even at 17, same age as Joseph, was given this understanding of his destiny, who he would become. Now, Churchill, he was far from perfect, and his life, you know, was a ramshackle set of disasters. But the point is that sort of sense of destiny stayed with him, and he was always preparing himself for what was going to come, even though he didn't know what it was. He was always preparing himself based on that vision that he had of who he would be and what would happen in his life. And so, ultimately, when he did become the commander of, the Prime Minister in the UK during the war, he had prepared during his life for that. This was not a surprise to him. Even when he was 17, this had changed his life. And I think God might have planted that in his heart in some way. Even though he wasn't a particularly godly man, you know, that's something that happened. And it's the same with Joseph. Joseph was given these stories, these dreams, and these dreams were to prepare him for the future in his life. And I want to just sort of make us sort of step back and think a little bit about that, because I think that particularly when you're young, that, you know, every young person, when you talk to them, they all have ambitions or dreams or ideas of what they would like to do or what they would like to be. In fact, it's quite sad when you talk to a young person and they don't have any ambition, you know, when their ambition is kind of quashed, when they've been told all their lives that they're a failure and that they're never going to amount to much, you know, then, you know, you talk to them and it's like, well, sometimes when a young person who's in that situation becomes a Christian, somehow God speaks into their life and it changes things around and they suddenly change their aspirations. And, you know, their life changes and their direction changes and what's going to happen with their life changes. Now, I know, I do believe that God does speak, you know, through prophecy, through people. I don't think it happens quite as often as sometimes we like to make out. But I do think that, you know, if that does happen, it's something just to kind of treasure in your heart and hold lightly to see, you know, what's going to happen with it. But the point is that it's actually down to you to take that and work with it and say, okay, if God wants me to be this, then I'm going to set my life in that direction. And that is obviously what happens to Joseph. Now, the problem with Joseph is that, how can I put it? It's pretty obvious that his father sends him out to the other brothers to find out what they're doing, you know, and the other brothers don't want the father to know what they're doing. That's why later on in the story, when he's sent to one place by his father, he goes there and he meets a man, and the man says, actually, they're all in Dothan. You know, it's quite clear they hadn't told their dad what they were going to do, and they didn't want their father to know what was going on. And the thing about Joseph was he came back and he gave a bad report about his brothers. Well, it may have been a bad report, but it was actually an accurate report that he'd given about his brothers. And we know this because later on, when Jacob is basically he's dying and he's blessing the various tribes, he gives this sort of blessing to some of the brothers. Simon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are weapons of violence. Let me not enter into their council. Let me not join their assembly. For they have killed men in their anger and hamstrung oxen as they pleased. Cursed be their anger so fierce and fury so cruel. I will scatter them in Jacob, disperse them in Israel. So, you know, Jacob's saying later on, you know, my family are shambles. They're a band of brigands that go around, you know, stealing people's sheep and killing people. You know, that's who they are, and they're out of my control. And Joseph had obviously brought a report back to his dad, saying, this is what they're doing. And that's partly why they didn't like him. But also, the reason I think why they didn't like him was that, I want to ask you a question. What do you think is the most well-known verse in the Bible? If you went out in the street and asked somebody what the most well-known verse in the Bible was, they may not even know it's in the Bible, but what do you think it is? Okay. All right. Well, those are all interesting examples. But actually, I don't think that's true. I think that the most well-known and most often used verse in the Bible in our culture today is, do not judge or you too will be judged. That's the one Nobody wants you to criticize their behavior or judge their behavior or call it up to question. You know, and if you do that and they assume that that's some way related to your faith, then, you know, they're saying, don't judge me. Don't judge. And that actually is the best known verse in the Bible at the moment. But the problem is it's taken out of context, because we are actually to judge people's behavior. We're to judge what's good behavior and what's bad behavior for us. And we're to have an opinion about other people's behavior. It's just that we're not to make that into a point of sort of self-righteous criticism of people. We're to, you know, encourage them in a right way, but not do it in a way that gets up their noses. And unfortunately, that, I think, is what Joseph did. I mean, he was a righteous guy. He was a good fella. He was the one good apple in the bad pick. And you find out about all the others throughout the story. You know, they're all a bad bunch, and he's the one good one. But unfortunately, he tended to get up their nose because of the way he went about telling them. And again, you know, particularly if you're a new Christian, but actually quite a lot of older Christians as well, can get up everybody's nose. Because, you know, we just don't have the wisdom to be righteous without being obnoxious. Now, you know, Jesus, on the other hand, he was righteous. Nobody could accuse him of sin. But people who were sinners loved being around him. You know, he was a bit like a good doctor. You know, you go to a good doctor, you don't want him to say, oh, no, it's okay, don't worry. You want him to tell you what's wrong. I mean, he may tell you what's wrong and you decide not to do anything about it. You know, I'm still going to eat my cream cakes and I'm still going to go out and take a drink. You know, that may be your choice, but you would rather the doctor told you, don't take cream cakes and don't go out and take a drink, than say, oh, it doesn't matter, right? You'd rather the doctor told the truth. And Jesus did that. Jesus told the sinners, the truth. But they loved him nonetheless, because he wasn't obnoxious, because he was wise. And unfortunately, Joseph, I suspect, wasn't very wise. Of course, that goes with youth. If you're only 17, you might not know a lot. And I have to say, you know, I became a Christian when I was 12, so I was that obnoxious youth, really, you know. You know, I've got lots of stories of, you know, things I've said or done that have been really pretty judgmental in a bad way. And a lot of it came out of my own sort of, you know, the thing is, when you see people doing stuff and you know you shouldn't do it, but you rather like to do it, you become kind of, you know, judgmental about it, you know, and you say, well, yeah, you're dreadful that you're doing all this stuff. I wish I could join you, kind of thing. rather than, you know, actually really believing it isn't good for them, it isn't good for you, and you'd rather not do it, you know. But obviously, you know, Joseph had a bit to learn in that area. I'll just say that, you know, Paul says in Philippians 2:14, do everything without grumbling or arguing, so you may become blameless and pure, children of God without fault in a warped and crooked generation. Then you will shine among them like stars in the sky. And that's our calling, to shine like stars in the sky. You know, Charlie was talking a bit about, you know, sharing the truth of Jesus. Well, frankly, you don't have any right to share the truth of Jesus unless you're actually living it, you know. In some sense, you don't have to be perfect, but, you know, if you're shining like a light in the sky, then people might be interested in finding out about that light, and they might ask you a few questions. You might have opportunities to share. But if you aren't shining like a light in the sky, you know, you don't really have very much to say, and it's probably best that you just keep your mouth shut. I once came across, in fact, he was the deputy chairman of British Gas, and he's a Christian man, you know, sir, whatever his name was, super fellow, actually really interesting guy to talk with. But he said some of the worst people he'd come across in his work environment were Christians. You know, they were conniving, they were ambitious, just knocked everybody down, they lied, they took the credit but never, and always gave the blame to their employees, and all this sort of stuff. And he said they were just a nasty bunch, but they were Christians, and he was ashamed of them. He said it was an embarrassment to have these Christians in the workplace, because they were just nasty bunch. He said some of the nicest people he came across weren't Christians at all, but, you know, just had a certain integrity about them. And again, you know, our calling is to be those people that shine like lights, that have integrity, that are just good to be around. Now, sometimes, obviously, we will be called to say, and to stick our necks out and say, this is wrong, we shouldn't do it. But I think you have to keep your powder dry for those occasions. If you're constantly harping on about things, that's not good. But if you've earned the right to say something to somebody, it might be taken in a better light. Anyway, that's Joseph as a teenager. Let's move on a little bit. So, Genesis 37, a bit further. Now, his brothers had gone to graze their father's flock near Shechem, and Israel said to Joseph, as you know, your brothers are grazing the flock near Shechem. Come, I'm going to send you to them. Very well, he replied. So he said to him, go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flocks, and bring word back to me. And he sent them off to the valley from the valley of Hebron. When Joseph arrived at Shechem, a man found him wandering around in the fields and asked him, what are you looking for? He replied, I'm looking for my brothers. Can you tell me where they are grazing the flocks? Oh, they've moved from here, the man answered. I heard them say, let's go to Dothan. So basically, they hadn't told their dad where they were going, right? And he'd been sent out to check up on what they were doing. And obviously, you know, they'd moved on. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan. But they saw them in the distance. Before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. Here comes that dreamer, they said to each other. Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams. See, obviously killing wasn't something that was particularly unusual for them. You know, if you're going to kill your brother, you probably killed somebody else. When Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. Let's not take his life, he said. Don't shed any blood. Throw him into this cistern here in the wilderness and don't lay a hand on him. By the way, a cistern's kind of like a well. It's just somewhere where they stored water when the rains came, and then they stayed there until the dry season. Throw him into the cistern in the wilderness. Reuben said this to rescue him from them and take him back to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the ornate robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. The cistern was empty with no water in it. As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, what will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our own flesh and blood. The brothers agreed. So when the Midianites merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites who took him to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes and went back to his brothers and said, the boy isn't there. Where can I turn to now? Then they got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in the blood. They took the ornate robe back to his father and said, we found this. Examine it to see whether it's your son's robe. He recognized it and said, it's my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. And Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned for his son for many days. All his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. No, he said, I will continue to mourn until I join my son in the grave. So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. Just say a little bit about Jacob there. You know, I mean, this set up the family for really a terrible turned out to be 10, 15, 20 years, because the brothers all knew, except perhaps for Reuben, that the sons were, you know, that Joseph was alive, that they last saw him, he was okay. But the father, because they basically lied to him, assumed that Joseph was dead. So here is their father grieving, deeply, deeply upset about the death of their son. And them coming to him regularly and saying, cheer up, Dad. But not able to say the reason why the dad should cheer up. Because they've got this horrible big secret in the background that they're not able to tell their dad. That they actually sold him into Egypt. They can't tell him that. And so this thing grows and grows and grows to the point where, you know, Jacob is inconsolable in his grief for a long period of time. And the brothers are just compounding the lie more and more and more. And so their guilt is growing all the time. Goodness, you know, poor man. And I cannot tell him what I've really done. I just can't say. Later on in the story, we see how Joseph kind of plays that back and tries to unwind that for them. But we'll not come to that today. What we'll go on to is just look at a little bit of how Joseph reacted to his dreams and what happens when your bubble bursts. So I said at the beginning that, you know, Joseph had these dreams. And young people have dreams. And that's good. And that's great. Unfortunately, no matter where you are in life, those dreams can go sour. Like, you know, the bubble can burst. Things can go wrong. And the question is, what are we going to do when that happens? It will happen. There is no question about it. The question then is, though, is God faithful? Am I going to remain faithful to God? Or am I just going to throw in the towel and just pretend it's not the case? Now, one of the problems we have in the church is, and honestly, I feel this has come in a lot with, you know, a lot of the charismatic emphasis on healing and on prosperity and stuff like that. You know, there is a sense in which, yeah, if you pray, God will heal. And there is a sense in which if you pray, you know, God will provide. But that can turn into very quickly praying for the American dream. And then it becomes what somebody has called, this is great, narcissistic optimistic deism. You know, God exists to bless me and make my dreams come true. And, you know, God does not exist to bless you and make your dreams come true. He doesn't. He may give you dreams. He may give you hope for the future. But that's not the same as saying that life's going to be a rosy bundle. And for many people that become Christians, life turns to anything but a rosy bundle. Some of you know that I'm involved in a little bit, with some people in Lighthouse Church, which works primarily among Muslims and Hindus. And, you know, when people from that culture become a Christian, they get ostracized by their family. I mean, there's a real cost for young people becoming Christians in those circumstances. I mean, for sort of most sort of white English folks, you might get laughed at, but that's the most you can really hope will happen. But, you know, for folks from that sort of background, it's not a cheap decision. You know, life can become tough when you become a Christian. But let's just think a little bit about Jacob as well, because Joseph was the daughter of Rachel. And I'll just read a little bit of just prior to when we get to the story of Joseph. This is about Jacob. And God said to Jacob, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and increase in number. A nation, a community of nations will come from you, and kings will be among your descendants. The land I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give to you, and I will give this land to your descendants after you. And then God went up from the place where he had talked with him. And Jacob set up a stone pillar at that place where God had talked with him, and he poured out a drink offering on it. Jacob called the place where God had talked with him Bethel. So Jacob has had this amazing God experience, and God has spoken to him, and he set up a stone and called this place Bethel. It's still called Bethel today in Israel. They moved on from Bethel, and while they were still some distance from Ephrathah, Rachel began to give birth and had great difficulty. And as she was having great difficulty in birth, the midwife said to her, don't despair, you have another son. But she breathed her last, for she was dying. She named her son Benoni, but his father named him Benjamin. So Rachel died and buried on the way to Ephrathah, that is Bethlehem. Over her tomb, Jacob set a pillar, and that pillar still marks Rachel's tomb today. You see, here is a man of great faith whom God has spoken to personally, who carries the promises, but he couldn't pray for his wife and have her saved from a terrible circumstance, dying giving birth. Some of you know, my great-grandmother died giving birth to my dad, and the father was basically turned up at the hospital to get his wife and the baby and was given the baby. You just imagine the horror of that. It'd be dreadful. You know, and this happened to Jacob. And Jacob was a man of God. He's one of the patriarchs. He's one of the big guys in the Bible. So we can't really expect that those things won't happen to us. We can't. It's just wrong for us to do that. What we've got to understand from the Bible is that, yes, difficult things happen. They happen to these people as well. But they kept their faith. They kept the faith. They kept believing in God, that God would keep them. Now, interestingly, Rachel was buried in Bethlehem. And thousands of years later, Jesus was born in Bethlehem. And if you remember the story of Jesus' birth, there was a point at which Herod said, kill all the children in Bethlehem who are 2 years and younger. But Jesus is whisked away by his parents and manages to escape that because, again, of another dream that managed to get him escape and go down to Egypt. In the Bible, it says, you know, that that particular event was fulfilling a prophecy, Rachel weeping for her children. And so this circumstance, a way back when, a terrible thing that happened when a child died, a child didn't die, but Rachel died herself, actually leads forwards to the time when Christ will come. And again, a terrible thing happens around the birth of Christ. And yet, you know, even though Rachel is weeping for her children, some great hope is born later on. So again, you can sort of see the interrelatedness of all the things in the Bible and how this big, big story is going on, even through the tragedies of individual people's lives and things that happen in individual people's lives. The last thing I'm going to say today about Joseph is this little verse in Genesis 37, 31. They got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in the blood. Now, what's really interesting about that is one of the themes that you see going on throughout the Bible is the idea of sacrifice and of blood being shed in order to preserve somebody's life. And so Joseph's life has been preserved, but this animal has died and his coat has been dipped in that blood. And so that's what we call a type, a kind of picture of what's going on. I'll say there's a couple of other ones that we kind of missed. If you go back to when Adam and Eve are in the garden and they're naked and they sin and then they're ashamed, God kills animals and provides them with a coat, skins, to cover themselves. Again, blood is shed for their sins to be covered. So, Joseph, the blood was shed of the goat. Father's told a lie, but because that blood is shed, Joseph himself is not killed and is set free, or well, not set free, but certainly let go into slavery. Now in Revelation, just to bring this home to us a little bit, in 7:13 it says, one of the elders asked me, sir, this is like a vision that John's having, are these in white robes, who are they and where did they come from? I answered, sir, you know. And he said, these are they who have come out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. And so just to finish off in terms of hope, we know that, you know, the great tribulation is not necessarily some great time of tribulation in the future. It's even now for us and for many people in the world, great difficulty in life. And yet in that time of great difficulty in life, which Joseph himself experienced, we know that our robes are washed in that blood. That basically means that we are forgiven, that we're set free from our sin, that God accepts us and loves us and will carry us through those difficulties in life, through to that glorious future that he has for us. And that is the hope that we cling on to, even in the midst of all the difficulties that we face. So that's all I'm going to say about Joseph today. And maybe next time we'll get on a bit further with the story. Thank you.